State for the record, this is the Minnesota. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, September 20, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar today. This is our second of three cases. We did see on the closed circuit television that you were both here early. If you don't mind, if you're not waiting for anybody, we'd be happy to start early. If you are still waiting for people, then we can postpone it until 11:15, which is the scheduled time. Counsel?
I'm not waiting for anybody. I'm not either, so I'm starting.
Everyone's ready to go. All right. Thank you. This is A230092, Plaster v. State. Counsel, you're both familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Just state your name and your client's name and how you'd like us to reference you during your argument. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant Tyler Plaster on this appeal. And I'm fine with the court just referencing me as Mr. McLaughlin or Michael, whatever the court prefers.
Thank you.
In this case, Tyler Plaster was presented with the option of either pleading guilty or exercising his trial rights. A defendant must make an informed decision about pleading guilty. The defendant must know the pros and cons of pleading guilty versus going to trial. The benefit of a plea is always relative. Its benefit also always depends on the extent of the trial risk. Thus, to know how much a plea will benefit him, a client must understand what he would be risking by standing trial on the case. When evaluating a plea, defendant does not act alone. The defendant acts on the advice of an attorney. To be competent, the attorney must provide an informed assessment of the risks of trial and the consequences of the plea. The attorney may not provide inaccurate advice about the consequences a defendant will face if convicted after trial.
Well, doesn't it depend on how bad the miscalculation is? I mean, if it's a month as opposed to 3 years, that might make a difference, right?
Judge Smith, I believe that could potentially make a difference, especially on the prejudice prong. The way the case law has approached the deficiency prong, it really looks more at the nature of the consequence and whether the attorney provided either affirmative misadvice or just failed to advise. And the deficiency hasn't depended as much on the magnitude of the error, but I think when it gets to the prejudice prong, that could make a difference.
Well, but it does depend on the magnitude of the error, doesn't it? Because it's not ineffective to be wrong on a minor point. It could be if it's a major point.
I'd agree with that to an extent. I mean, I understand your point. The case law has drawn a distinction between, say, certain collateral consequences and direct consequences. And an attorney's duties vary depending on whether the consequence is classified as direct or collateral.
Well, and as far as the sentencing guidelines, people often make mistakes about sentencing guideline predictions.
And that's true. And So
is that ineffective assistance of counsel if you just goof on the number of months? That isn't always going to result in ineffective assistance of counsel, is it?
Under the case law, it would depend on exactly how the miscalculation occurred and what provision of the sentencing guidelines the attorney was misapplying. I mean, the case law in dealing with criminal history score, recognizes that a defendant in those cases has been advised that the court will make the ultimate determination of the guideline sentence and the criminal history. And so an attorney's factual opinion about the criminal history score a defendant will likely have isn't necessarily ineffective assistance. And part of that is because that's a factual issue that's not fully resolved at the time of the plea, and also because the defendant's advised that there's going to be a further court determination on that issue.
Where do we draw the line, though, counsel? I mean, the sentencing guidelines I don't think I'm out on a limb by saying that they're not always a model of clarity. There's a lot of misinterpretation of the sentencing guidelines. We see appeals involving questions of interpretation of the guidelines all the time. Many of those cases end up before the Minnesota Supreme Court, and sometimes they even disagree with us, unlikely as that may be. So I'm just wondering, is there some bright line rule that we can draw a line in the sand by saying when you are interpreting the guidelines this way, it's in ineffective assistance of counsel territory, but when you're interpreting the guidelines that way, maybe we're not in ineffective assistance territory. How do we, is that possible, or how do we do that?
It is possible, and this court would just need to treat the guidelines like any other source of legal authority that binds a court. So whether it's case law, statute, or guidelines, whether advice is ineffective assistance always depends on the clarity of the relevant legal rule and to the extent to which that advice conflicted with a clear rule. And here, the guideline provision at issue has been determined by the Minnesota Supreme Court to be unambiguous. In Bilbro versus State, the court held that the specific provision that deals with when a sentence is eligible to be sentenced permissive consecutive and when that depends on whether that that offense falls under list number 6 under the guidelines. That issue is determined by the plain language of the guidelines, and that language is unambiguous. So,
and then help me out here. That case was decided in 2019. Was that before or after the advice that was given regarding, which I also thought happened in 2019? Was that before or after the advice that counsel provided to Mr. Plastner?
Let me just check the dates on that. So I don't have the decision date of Bilbro in front of me. I do know that the plea occurred on December 11th, 2019. So it's possible the Bilbro's decision was announced before the advice was given. But
can I ask you, let's just assume that Bilbro was decided before in May of 2019, that is what it looks like to me, and the plea was in December. Bilbro was not an ineffective assistance of counsel post-conviction relief case. It was an error by the district court. That was the issue. Are you aware of any cases in which this specific issue, not the separate issue of guidelines based on criminal history, but the specific issue, concurrent versus consecutive, under the guidelines, that has constituted deficient advice?
I'm not aware of any Minnesota authority that's dealt with that specific issue.
Okay, well, let me just ask you a follow-up question. Say we presume to agree that counsel's performance was deficient. On the prejudice prong, it looks to me that the district court found that Mr. Plaster's sole concern when entering the plea agreement was avoiding any extension of his anticipated release date from the controlled substance offense, and that accepting the offer was simple logic to avoid additional time in prison. Are you challenging those factual findings by the district court?
Yes.
So why should we conclude that there's insufficient evidence in the record to support those findings?
I mean, as an initial point, I'd argue that this court reviews ineffective assistance claims de novo. So although abuse of discretion applies generally to post-conviction claims, ineffective assistance is reviewed de novo by this court. So I don't know that the district court's factual findings on that point are entitled to the same deference in other contexts.
How do we do that? I mean, are we supposed to look at it like a suppression motion?
I mean, the case law said that de novo applies to ineffective assistance claims. I mean, I guess at the very least, this court would have to apply the factual record. I mean, it could apply the factual findings that the district court made, but it would still have to apply that to evaluate independently de novo whether that establishes a reasonable probability that Mr. Plaster would have not pleaded guilty.
But so, back to Judge Eade's question, what is it about those factual findings that you take issue with today?
Take issue with that Judge Eade failed to look at Mr. Plaster's decision-making in light of the correct advice. The federal circuit courts have stressed that when you're looking at, ineffective assistance claim and you get to the prejudice prong, it all comes down to the defendant's decision-making. And you can't look at the decisions the defendant made when incorrectly advised as conclusive of how the defendant would have responded if the defendant had the correct advice. You have to
ask you that, because you did your own calculation of what it would have been under the existing pre-Robinette law, and your calculation was 102 months. And that would have made his outdate with his credit, it would have been September 15th, 2023 release under that properly calculated guideline scenario, pre-Robinette, and that would be almost a year after what you indicated would have been, or was, his controlled substance offense release date. So, I mean, that's what you put in your brief. And at the hearing, when he's asked, when Mr. Plaster's asked, do you want to proceed with the plea negotiation as outlined here today, he says, I do, under the pretense that there will be no additional time as a result of this plea. So that was directly from him. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the case, there's some attempt to reconsider that at the evidentiary hearing and the post-conviction motion, but if that's the case, why isn't it true that there's no prejudice here and that factual finding that his sole concern is, just as he said, no additional time, when he would have served almost a year additional, even by your own admission, under the properly calculated guidelines?
The reason is that when he made that statement, he thought the alternative he was looking at was 7 years beyond what his current outdate was going to be on the drug case.
But that's not what he said. He said no additional time. He didn't say 7 years.
He didn't, but the fundamental question for him that day was, do I take this plea deal that's presented to me, or do I go to trial and risk 7 additional years in prison, according to my attorney's advice? So his thinking at the time was based on different inputs. I mean, his evaluation of the plea agreement had an entirely different input for the sentencing risk. So you can't take what he said at that time as conclusive of what he would have done if he'd been correctly advised.
But then isn't that his burden? I mean, he did get an evidentiary hearing in this case. So isn't it his burden to show up at the evidentiary hearing and say, or for his counsel to elicit from him, if I would have had the correct advice, my thought process would have been different. And that I did not see in the record.
He did testify to at the evidentiary hearing that if he'd known the true sentencing risk, he would not have entered the guilty plea.
But that's because he didn't want to serve any additional jail time, not for some other reason. Or did I miss something?
No, I think at the plea hearing he articulated a motivation for taking the plea, and obviously that was the main benefit of the plea, that it was going to get him out of prison sooner. But that articulation doesn't mean that there were no other considerations relevant to him when deciding whether or not to reject the plea. I mean, a criminal sexual conduct conviction was a meaningful consequence regardless of the sentence he received on it. Require registration would be a lifelong stigmatization based on that offense. So the fact that he said, I would rather plead guilty, get out of prison right away, when the alternative was 7 additional years in prison, that doesn't speak to his decision making at the time. If he had received effective assistance, if he'd been advised that he was only looking at a maximum of less than a year. And I'd also note, too, that that was just a potential outcome. That possible trial sentence that would extend beyond his release date was only if he got all three convictions, if all three ran consecutively, and if he got the maximum guideline sentence in all three. So, I mean, if you had been correctly advised, it would have been that there's a low risk you could end up with more prison time. It's a possible risk. And he would have had to weigh that against the benefit he would have of going to trial, of achieving exoneration and avoiding these convictions. And for prejudice, this court only is looking at whether it's sufficient to undermine confidence. Is it sufficient to undermine confidence that the defendant would have acted the same way if he'd been correctly advised? And there's more than enough here to at least make a fact finder uncomfortable that the defendant would have acted the same. If he'd known that he was looking at six fewer years in prison than what his attorney had told him he was looking at after trial, that at least undermines confidence that he would have made the same decision to plead guilty. And on that basis, we'd ask that you allow him to withdraw his plea and just give him a trial. That's all he's asking for. He's willing to accept the risks of that trial, but because he was misadvised on his plea, he's asking for that trial.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherman County attorney, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. If you could refer to me as Mr. Kennedy, that's fine with me. In this case, the post-conviction court found that Mr. Plaster would have accepted any plea agreement that did not affect his anticipated release date. There's ample support for that conclusion in the record, which means that his ineffective assistance of counsel claim fails. He cannot show the...
Are you conceding it was ineffective assistance?
I'm not.
Do you think it was?
I don't, Your Honor. There was a question earlier about what sort of bright line this court could draw for ineffective assistance of counsel in interpreting the guidelines. And I think the place where you could draw that sort of line is if there's a mandatory provision that doesn't provide any room for the court to exercise discretion or depart from the guidelines. So for example, criminal offense severity is non-discretionary unless it's an unranked offense. So if trial counsel had, instead of looking at the guideline grid for criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree, and had instead provided advice about criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, because there is a ministerial error in that interpretation of the guidelines, I think that may rise to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel. But for something like this, where there is discretion, there is the possibility of a departure, just like in Ho.
I mean, there's always the possibility of a departure in every situation.
Correct, and that's why...
So then there would never be ineffective assistance using this analysis?
Not regarding what I was just saying about looking at the incorrect severity level, because you're providing demonstrably false advice about what the consequences of a specific offense are, instead of just working through the guidelines saying, here's the correct severity level, here's an estimation of your criminal history, this is what I think you're looking at in terms of exposure.
But wasn't there demonstrably incorrect advice about the presumptive sentence given the circumstances here?
Again,
putting a departure possibility aside, the advice that was given was wrong.
The advice that was given is wrong if you accept Mr. Plaster's version of events, and I don't think that the district court did that, so the court would have to second-guess the post-conviction court's fact-finding. If we look at the prejudice analysis, that's the easiest place to see it. Because for the court to say, we're going to take any plea agreement that didn't extend your out date, the district court had to reject some of Mr. Plaster's testimony. And that testimony is identified in the findings of fact as testimony, claims, beliefs, or statements, instead of being a declaratory statement from the court about what facts were found. And if we look back at the deficient performance allegations, those claims, too, are described in the findings of fact as testimony, claims, belief, or statements. They weren't actually found as trial counsel told him this, trial counsel advised him that.
But the district court didn't discredit his version of events in the description of what his counsel advised him with respect to the what the possible consequences of
not,
the plea.
Not explicitly, but that sort of analysis can happen, or that sort of credibility waiving can be implicit. And we look at the way that the legal issues are analyzed, and again, that prejudice prong gives us a roadmap to see if there's some qualification in the findings of fact, it means that that fact was not found. I agree that as a matter of fact, Mr. Plaster testified to those things, but wishing doesn't make it so, and he did not prove those things to the district court. So for this court to reverse, you would have to unwind those fact findings by the post-conviction court.
But you're basically saying the district court didn't make adequate findings then.
I think that the facts are adequately found by the district court because you can look through the analysis and say...
Part of that is weighing credibility and making findings about credibility.
Which can be an implicit finding. And if you look at how the facts were analyzed...
It should be explicit, shouldn't it?
In a perfect world, I would have appreciated that. It would have made my job right now a lot easier. But we do have statements in the conclusion. We have the district court saying that...
Let me ask this. What do you think your stronger argument is, that there was not effective assistance of counsel or that there is not prejudice?
I think that my strongest argument is that there was no prejudice because the post-conviction court explicitly found that he was going to accept any plea offer or plea agreement that did not extend his out date. And the district court rejected his testimony at the post-conviction hearing that he would have taken some other course of action with different advice. He was...
What about the evidence that he said he was going to present? I'm trying to remember if there were explicit findings about the weight of that testimony or if that was...
About the defense?
Yeah.
The post-conviction court noted that he claimed there was going to be a defense presented, but in its analysis said it was a weak defense and essentially discredited. So my interpretation of that, and I think the post-conviction court's decision shows that it didn't believe he was going to present that defense. It believed that he was going to take whatever plea offer got him out of prison without an extension of his release date.
Can I ask you about your implicit findings argument? Because in the conclusions of law, the district court, in addressing the argument that his attorney, Mr. Plaster's trial attorney, misadvised him that his criminal sexual conduct offenses could run consecutive to his controlled substance offense sentence, instead of saying, I don't find that testimony credible or the court does not find it credible, accepts that for purposes of ruling that contrary to his claims, Minnesota law holds that misinterpreting the Minnesota sentencing guidelines is not incompetence when there's uncertainty about the guidelines. So the court didn't need to reach that conclusion if it, as you are saying it did, implicitly rejected Mr. Plaster's testimony that he was misadvised. So do you have a response to that?
I think it's a bit of belt and suspenders. It was the court trying to say, even if the Court of Appeals disagrees with me on the factual finding, on the legal issue, Mr. Plaster is still not entitled to post-conviction relief here. And if...
I don't see the belt there because the court never found it not to be credible. I mean, usually a court that's rejecting a fact alleged by a claimant is going to say the court does not find that credible and is not going to go to reaching an issue that's not before it. I wanted to ask you... with regard to this issue of the guidelines, do you have a response to the appellant's argument that under Bilbro, the guidelines use clear language regarding non-authorization of permissive consecutive sentencing?
Well, I think just that a provision in the guidelines is unambiguous doesn't mean that it's also non-discretionary. So this gets back to the issue of Ho, where there was advice about a worst-case scenario.
Right, but so I understand that, but you made an analogy at the beginning of your argument that of it would be ineffective if someone misread a severity level 4 offense as a severity level 1 offense. Mm-hmm. But assuming that that results in an advice that's within the statutory sentencing range, the statutory maximum, then why isn't that similarly a discretionary error that's like this issue with Bilbro, where it's a clear statement that this is a non-permissive, these offenses are not permissive for consecutive sentencing, as long as the advice is within the statutory maximum?
I think that gets to the prejudice side instead of the deficient performance side for whether the advice was ultimately...
Because I think this goes to Judge Frisch's question, right? Because the court is always free to depart, and no attorney can predict what might happen if later the state were to file a notice of seeking an aggravated sentence and what evidence the state might then use to support that.
But the court can't depart from offense severity because...
But it could reach the same result as long as it's within the statutory maximum, and that's my point.
I agree, and I think that that's where... There's one conversation about deficient performance, and there's another conversation about prejudice.
And, I'm just asking you about deficient performance and not prejudice.
Okay. So I think that there is a difference because one provision has the possibility of discretion and the other one does not. I think that that provides the bright line that this court was asking about during my friend's presentation. The question that you're asking isn't exactly before us today, so I hadn't thought through those sorts of steps completely.
I guess fundamentally is there any, aside from your severity level 1 versus severity level 4, is there any other type of guidelines error that you can imagine would constitute deficient performance under Minnesota law in terms of advice?
I might be a little bit long story long with this answer, so I'd ask you to just bear with me. So if going through the federal cases that were cited in the briefs, those talk about specific modifiers that exist under the federal guidelines. I'm not very familiar with the federal guidelines because I've never practiced in federal court. There are some modifiers like that that exist in state law. So a 609.11 offense, while it may ordinarily be a presumptive stayed sentence, if you don't have that modifier, if a weapon was involved, it becomes a presumptive commit to the Commissioner of Corrections. So if there was some sort of error in failing to provide that advice, saying you're looking at stayed time if you accept this plea instead of you're looking at a mandatory minimum or you're looking at a presumptive commit to the commissioner. Those sorts of issues, I think, could rise to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel. But something here...
Even though the court could dispositionally depart, conceivably, and decide to give someone a commit?
If we're talking about I might be getting over my skis a little bit. If we're talking about yes, because a defense attorney is required to give accurate advice about the mandatory minimum, the statutory maximum, and conditional release. So if there is a mandatory minimum, that's already required by Minnesota law. And what appellant is asking you to do here is to break new ground and say an error in interpreting the sentencing guidelines is ineffective assistance of counsel. And that's a pretty big deviation from this court's prior case law, existing case law in the Eighth Circuit, and I'm not aware of anything from the state Supreme Court saying that it is constitutionally deficient to make a mistake in your calculation under the guidelines.
Counsel, I just want, in your remaining time, I would like you to address Mr. McLaughlin's argument today, and that is Mr. Plaster was deprived of the essence of his decision-making because he was provided with ineffective or incorrect advice. So he was not in a position to even consider what his options were because he was misadvised as to what the potential consequences of the plea was. So why isn't that just presumptively prejudicial, given that he didn't know what he didn't know at the time that he entered the plea? I think I have the argument framed the way that counsel presented it today.
In my recollection from prior review of the law is that the only time you get to a presumption of deficient performance is if opposing counsel is essentially acting on behalf of the state.
I'm talking about a presumption of prejudice.
Oh, presumption. Excuse me, I meant a presumption of prejudice. The time that you get to a presumption of prejudice is if the defendant's attorney is, in effect, an agent of the state. We don't have that here. Instead, we have supposedly incorrect advice about the worst case scenario. And this court has previously said we're okay with that type of worst case scenario advice, even if the disparity between the plea agreement and the advice we're giving is 82 months versus life. And I don't think that the court can reach a different conclusion here without acknowledging that it was extremely incorrect in that earlier case. And I think
it's incorrect, but extremely incorrect.
Well, life is a long time.
If
I could just have a couple more minutes or.
Well, not a couple more minutes, but you can sum up.
Sum up. All right. Mr. Plaster has failed to prove prejudice. Additionally, because he received competent advice about the worst case scenario that he could face if the matter went to trial. He has failed to prove that he received ineffective assistance of counsel, and the court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Beginning with just some of the case law that Mr. Candy cited, the case that he references about the worst case scenario case, that's distinguishable from this case because there the attorney both advised the client of the likely sentence, which was a guideline sentence, and also advised the client that there was also a worst case scenario of a life sentence. So here there was no dual advice. The only advice that was given was the consecutive sentence that they run consecutive to the prior sentence. So Ho is distinguishable, and it doesn't require this court to overrule Ho to rule for Mr. Plaster. And then as far as the argument that it would require this court to break new ground to rule for Mr. Plaster, it would not. And the reason is the State versus Ellis Strong. That case involved a collateral consequence, not a direct consequence. And this court held that inaccurate advice about a collateral consequence was ineffective assistance. So, you know, regardless of whether all the line this court draws on guidelines, what attorney must advise, what attorney must not advise, this court has held that any significant sentencing consequence, whether collateral or direct, is ineffective if the attorney affirmatively misadvises on the consequence. And that's what occurred here. So this case would require nothing more than an application of Ellis Strong to rule that counsel was deficient.
But are there any cases you're aware of in which a guidelines error, any Minnesota cases or cases from any other state with a similar sentencing guidelines scheme in which misadvice of a similar nature that you've alleged occurred here constituted deficient performance?
Well, this court in unpublished cases has found ineffective assistance based on a guidelines error that resulted in a significantly longer sentence, or where it resulted in the attorney advising the defendant that he faced significantly more time than he actually faced. So even though it didn't specifically deal with the consecutive concurrent issue, it found that where where any misinterpretation of the guidelines results in a much longer sentence than what the defendant really faces, that can be deficient performance. In that case, the case is cited in the brief. I believe it was Vargas was the case that held that. And then in federal law, the federal circuit courts have found that a misinterpretation of the federal sentencing guidelines can be ineffective assistance. And the analysis in those cases is if it reveals a basic misunderstanding of the guidelines, and if the miscalculation is a gross miscalculation of the sentence that the defendant actually faces. So there is authority that have applied ineffectiveness claims to guidelines interpretations. And in other areas of law that are equally binding on the district court, case law, statute, this court doesn't, go through the specific statutory provision and ask, have we found ineffectiveness on this specific statute? The analysis is always, was the attorney's advice inconsistent with law that bound the court or law that was applicable to the case? So I don't think the fact that there isn't a direct case on the concurrent consecutive question, I don't think precludes this court from finding the attorney ineffective. And the point that Judge Frisch asked about regarding when I was trying to explain about sort of how we have to look at Mr. Plaster's decision-making if he'd been correctly advised and what he thought based on erroneous advice doesn't control. That the case that spoke to this, one of the cases that spoke to this was a D.C. Circuit case, United States versus Knight, 981 F3D 1095. And there the court stated that a defendant's assessment of what was in his best interest could well have changed had he been correctly advised. The choices that the defendant actually made do not necessarily shed any useful light on the choices that he would have made if he'd been properly advised. And I think the same applies here. The fact that Mr. Plaster wanted to get out of prison as soon as possible because he thought at trial he faced another 7 years in prison, that doesn't necessarily control what he would have done if his attorney had told him that the worst case scenario was less than a year of additional time in prison. Again, the core argument is...
In this case, it wasn't just a year, though, as a possibility, was it? It could have been more.
It could have been. Well, it could not have been more unless the court had departed from the sentencing guidelines. And there was no notice of departure filed. There had been no Blakely proceedings. I mean, under Minnesota law, the district court lacks legal authority to go above the guidelines unless there's a properly conducted Blakely proceeding. And none of that happened. And also, the attorney did not advise Mr. Plaster, there's a possibility the state could file a notice for departure, and then you'd have a right to a Blakely hearing. There was none of that. Just a flat estimate that was clearly incorrect under the guidelines. That was incorrect, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that the district court would have had any authority to go above that guideline sentence.
All right, counsel, your time has expired. Thank you very much. The matter is now submitted. Your arguments and your briefs were very helpful. And this will conclude our calendar today. Thank you. We're on recess. Thank you very much.
All rise.